Hi there and welcome. Jonathan here. These talks are offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to these practices. Your support makes a big difference. If you feel inspired to make a donation, please go to jonathanfaust.com. Thank you.
I did my first Vipassana retreat, I think it's over 30 years ago, with a teacher by the name of S.N. Goenka. And I'll never forget the first thing he said at the first Dharma talk after the first full day of practice. It's hard to do his voice, but it went something like this.
You have completed the first day of your retreat. You have 9 days remaining.
So you have completed the first day of your retreat.
You have 6 days remaining.
On retreat, it's important to monitor your reaction to things. And your reaction to that might be, wonderful, 6 more days of silence. Or your reaction might be like, I can't leave, they've got my cell phone. It's a clever little ceremony we did. A few retreats back, someone shared in a small group how they signed on to be the bell ringer. And the first morning, they were out in the morning ringing the bell in the darkness. And he was just thinking to himself, I cannot find the words to describe how wonderful this moment it is and how to be here. And then he described how at 7:30, 90 minutes later, he was thinking, I have made a terrible mistake. So have you noticed any thoughts today? Maybe a little unsteadiness from time to time? Tonight I'd like to talk about what can arise in your practice, and particularly when you deepen your attention. And some suggestions as to how you can work with these states when they arise. First, I'd like to talk about how you can cultivate balance and to share a formula that could be helpful for working through challenging energies. And I'd like to talk about how to be with the energies of pushing and pulling that invade your experience. How to work with the times when you don't have enough energy or maybe you have too much energy. And finally, to talk a little bit about how to work with doubt and that ruthless critic that's usually right there in the background. At home, I have one of the best morning routines I can possibly imagine. I feel so grateful for it. Every morning I can, before sunrise, I get out on the Potomac River on my paddleboard. It's just me and the board. And some very expensive cameras. I have a camera with a big telephoto and a wide angle set up on a tripod on my board. And Jerry Seinfeld said after his experience of scuba diving that he thought, I'm not sure I want to be into a sport where I'm thinking, don't die, don't die. And it's kind of the same for me, because where I go paddling on the Potomac River, it's very wide, it's rocky, there are lots of islands. The current can be really tricky, so in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, don't flip, don't flip. So I pay a lot of attention to balance. The rule on the river is you never get sideways to the current. And there are lots of rocks that are dark, and they're right under the surface, so with practice, you learn how to read the river. You can see the slightest signs of a disturbance or a change in the current that indicate you have to pay attention. And it's become kind of second nature to me after these years of paddling, but there are always some surprises. And in the same way, as you navigate through life, you're always seeking balance. and you're always being pulled off center. And on retreat, particularly when you slow everything down and you pay attention to the moment-to-moment arising of phenomena and how you relate to it, chances are you will see ever more intimately what pulls you off balance. How many times today did you start over? How many times did you find yourself kind of out of balance and having to recalibrate and come back and start the practice once again? I thought it might be nice for us just to take a few minutes just to settle in and refresh what this practice is. So if you like, you can close your eyes. You might invite your attention to a particular anchor, just a point in the sense field, the breath or sound, or the felt sense of the body. Just reflect on this quality of arriving. And you might inquire in this moment, if there is nothing to add or nothing to take away, what is here? You might, as you're ready, let your eyes open, or if you like, you can remain with your eyes closed. An important part of our practice is this quality of cultivating concentration. And it's all about starting again. You choose an anchor. As Pat said this morning, the breath or sounds or someplace in the body, and you rest your attention there. At some point, you realize that your mind is somewhere else, and you come back. You recenter, you re-relax, you re-arrive, and you receive what's happening right now and right here. Sometimes you may find yourself deeply and intimately with the anchor and notice that there's a lot going on in the background. There are comings and goings of all kinds of phenomena, sensations, thoughts, emotions, different mental states pass through. And I'd like to review a most fundamental practice, which most of us here, I imagine, are familiar with. A practice that can help to support you when you find the mind is gone, particularly when the mind is gone and caught in a challenging state. And I can think of no better story that illustrates this than this classic teaching story. A story of a yogini sitting in her cave, who's meditating calmly. And these three demons enter into her cave. And the demons they're whirling around, making a disturbance. And she notices, and she calmly gets up and starts building a little fire. She's so non-reactive, these demons get a little irritated, so they ramp it up a little bit, horrible sounds and images. And again, quite calmly, she takes a little pot of water and puts it over the fire. And again, she's so non-reactive, the demons become enraged, and they throw everything they've got at her. Again, calmly, she puts out these teacups on the table. And finally, after this horrific display by the demons, they stop and they say, "What is going on? We are your three deepest wounds, your three worst nightmares, and here you are building this little fire, putting on this tea kettle and putting out these cups. What gives?" And she says, "Well, you've been here before and you'll be here again. So in the meantime, what kind of tea would you like?" To me, that is the practice right there. The acronym which we use quite often, RAIN, R-A-I-N. To recognize what is here. Just simply to recognize and name it. To ask if you can allow it, if you can make room, if you can accept, if you can say yes to what is here. The I, to be intimate, to investigate what is here. Quite the opposite of what we usually do, which is to want to nuke it or make it go away, but to sit down and have tea with it. And the N, to nourish what is here with loving presence, to explore the effect of compassion and kindness with whatever may present itself. It's a helpful technique. I see it as a technology, if you will, that can help you to stay present. And we will be referring to this throughout the week, and Tara will be taking a deeper dive into how this works tomorrow. But I'd like to talk about these five states and how to work with them when they come to visit you. As much as we can be lost in our life experience, it's important to remember that at any time we can call ourselves back. One of my favorite readings from a friend of mine by the name of Dana Falls. My program just crashed. It's back. It only takes a reminder to breathe, a moment to be still, and just like that, something in me settles, softens, and makes space for imperfections. The harsh voice of judgment drops to a whisper, and I remember again that life is not a relay race, that we will all cross the finish line, that waking up to life is what we were born for. As many times as I forget, catch myself charging forward without even knowing where I'm going, that many times I can make the choice to stop, to breathe and be, and walk slowly into the mystery. It's helpful to remember that no matter what is passing through, no matter how caught we may be, that there is the possibility of pausing as we explored, remembering the refuges of wakefulness, of looking closely at what is true, and calling on this energy of love and compassion and kindness. But of course, when you cultivate an intention to be present, you begin to notice how you're not present. There are names for these five classic states. Sometimes they're called the hindrances. The word hindrance kind of implies they're kind of like flies floating around. Other names are the obstacles, or the challenges, or the sticking points. Or one of the phrases that I really like is the defilements. I thought there has to be a punk band somewhere called the Defilements. But you can also think of them as energies. You can think of them as weather systems that pass through. You can think of them as just mental states that are neither good nor bad. Rumi says, the dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from within. When we encounter these states of pushing, of pulling, of too little energy, too much energy, of doubt, we want to make them wrong. We want to nuke them, make them go away. But it's helpful to remember this phrase from the third Zen patriarch. Make the slightest distinction between good and bad, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So how do we be with this reflex of pushing and pulling that's so built into who we are. A few years ago, I was invited to a professional football game. I was curious to see what one was like. And it was the New England Patriots versus the Washington Indigenous Persons here in D.C. The Tuesday morning quarterback, Greg Easterbrook, calls them the Potomac Drainage Basin Indigenous Persons football team, which I kind of like. But watching this game, I actually found it to be traumatizing. There was a lot of alcohol being consumed, and the social inhibitions were lowered, and there were a lot of Patriots fans along with the Indigenous Persons fans. And it was interesting to watch because everyone's emotions were really heightened. So if one team caught a pass, one side of the stadium was just screaming with joy and the other side was just in the pit of despair. When someone went up the middle and was thrown for a loss, one side would scream with joy, the other would scream with sorrow. When one team clipped someone else, the other group screamed at the others. And it's an extreme example. But the point that I really came away with was that when your mind is tethered to aversion and craving, it's like a yo-yo, up and down and up and down. How many times today did you find yourself caught in judgment, anger, blame? How many times did you find yourself caught in planning and fantasy and the mind far away, thinking about the future? And these two extremes tend to run our lives. The practice is all about stimulation and response. Something happens, and before you know it, you're caught in a reactive state. Something happens and you're caught in some form of aversion. Anger, judgment, blame, ill will, hatred. Something happens and you find yourself lost in all the different flavors of craving, of wanting, of desire, of planning, of fantasy. And when you slow down, as you've done today and as you will continue to do, you will begin to see this dance more intimately. From where does this arise, this aversion, this craving? The key is to look at your immediate experience, how it's arising through your body. So a little example today of aversion, and particularly anger. This reminds me of a quick aside of someone when I went to their first retreat with an Asian teacher. And the teacher kept saying, bring your attention back to your anger. So I think, okay, well, I guess I'm a little annoyed with my mom. Let me think about that. And then later said, come back to your anger. Let's see, what else am I angry about? And only realized later that it was anchor, not anger. So in case there's any confusion. So about 4 hours ago, I was working on my talk, and I suddenly heard this whining sound of these two cycle engines. Maybe you heard it. This sound that only comes from dirt bikes. And they were somewhere nearby on a farm or off in some trails here. And they were kind of rapidly accelerating and deaccelerating and so forth. And I know that sound really well. It's just this annoying sound that you just can't get out of your head. And before I knew it, I was cursing these gas-sucking idiots for and offering the opposite of metta. And then suddenly I realized I've got demons in my cave. So to recognize, well, what's going on? Hear are these sounds, and it's tremendously annoying. I didn't feel much of a shift, but at least I was able to name what was there, which is important. And the second, to allow. Well, could I allow my experience to be? Could I actually say yes to this experience of profound annoyance? I really couldn't, but I tried. to be honest. So the I, to be intimate and investigate the experience. And here, the primary guidance for investigation is in the body, in the felt sense of the body, how your body holds that experience. And so for me, I could feel a tightness in my body. I could feel my eyes narrow. I could feel my jaw tighten. I could feel my breath get shallow. And I could feel a certain quality of meanness in my body. Being intimate with that experience kind of allowed me to explore the end part of that equation, to nourish this with kindness or compassion. And so I tried. And I realized pretty quickly that the fact is I actually used to own one of those motorcycles when I was 15. And it made me realize how utterly annoying I must have been to everyone around me. And I could sort of appreciate the narcissism of someone who engages in that as I did. And I began to feel a softening toward whoever these folks were out there, and a softening toward myself. And it felt like a shift, like something had kind of passed through. And then right about then, the sounds kind of died down for the day. And I just sort of enjoyed sort of the peace of feeling that, riding that wave of really kind of transforming anger into something else, into some form of a softening or empathy, and enjoyed that for a little while. And then they started up again, and it gave me the opportunity to go through that cycle once more. Aversion, anger, judgment, blame, ill will, they arise. They're all part of how you react to what is happening. Another quality, kind of the opposite of pushing away, is this quality of craving, of of wanting. Someone confessed at the end of a retreat that he had spent the entire retreat designing his dream house, going into all kinds of detail about how he would organize it, the hinges he would use on the shelves. And later he shared how sad he was because he felt that he actually missed the retreat. And I could really relate to that. And I realized that most of the sadness I feel in my life are all the times I wasn't there, all the times I was on my way somewhere else. Many people notice how, on a retreat, just how much time the mind is caught in fantasy, just lost in fantasy, lost in an endless series of planning. It's what the mind does. And you may find, as you begin to slow down even more and begin to identify these mind states as they arise, that you will have sort of your favorite places you go, kind of the favorite fantasies you'll go to. And as you slow down, it can be very helpful to really sense what was happening before that fantasy triggered. I've noticed for myself that there are just particular challenging spaces I'll find myself in, and before I know it, I'm lost in some sort of pleasant daydream as a way to kind of self-soothe. We'll talk more about that investigation later. So aversion and craving are very, very strong forces. They're very strong energies. Something arises, it's unpleasant, and before you know, you're in some strategy of trying to make it go away, trying to nuke it. Or something arises and you find yourself just gone into planning and fantasy. In some forms of practice, you can just pay attention to this, to just this reaction of pushing away and leaning toward. And I find when I can really pay attention, it's like a needle just going back and forth, just reacting to whatever's happening. So These forces of pushing away, of aversion, the forces of craving, of wanting, desire, fantasy, they're a big part of our experience. There are two other qualities that are helpful to explore, and they have to do, again, they're energetic. About having not enough energy and sometimes too much energy. And I think it's important to talk about the big one, because it's probably been a big theme today. And this one, I'll give you the demo. It kind of goes like this. Known as whiplash meditation. Or sloth and torpor. Which always, to me, sounds like the name of a law firm. Sloth and torpor is so much a part of our practice. And so much a part, particularly on this first day. When you have an intention to be fully present, to begin to bring the awareness and more contact with the body, and you close your eyes and you listen to the body as to what it needs, the body begins to tell you, and you begin to drift. And it's very important to acknowledge that we are an overstimulated and depleted culture. And if you find yourself lost in sloth and torpor, it's very helpful to make a distinction between it being coming from something biological or maybe something more emotional or psychological. My guess is that for many of us, if you're experiencing that sloth and torpor, the heaviness, the sleepiness, that it may well be biological. So how do you work with this state when it arises? The first is to notice it. Again, to ask, is it biological? Is it something directly from the body? You may be exhausted, in which case it can be very, very helpful to take some extra time to rest. It's a beautiful act of kindness. In the sitting practice itself, sloth and torpor is not enough energy. So there are a few things you can do. One is to deepen your breath, which might bring a little bit more aliveness. It's rather subtle, but it can be helpful to open your attention to sound. Sounds can be just a little more stimulating, which may help you to stay present. You may find it helpful to open your eyes. Again, as you open your eyes, you're bringing in a little more stimulation, which may be just enough to bring you to a little more of a sense of steadiness. And you can also stand up at your seat. And that can be very, very helpful. To simply stand, bring in a little bit more energy. And you may find that that weather system of heaviness and sleepiness will move on. It's important to remember that with all of these states, that they're impermanent, but they feel permanent. Perhaps you've had that experience in meditation where the heaviness and the sleepiness is so intense that you feel like you'll never wake up again. By opening to sound, by standing, by deepening the breath, that impermanent system sometimes can shift quickly. So on the one hand, energy can be very low. On the other hand, sometimes the energy can be so high that there's a quality of restlessness, a weather system of restlessness that oftentimes has to do with a quality of worry where the mind simply cannot settle. And you might just reflect on this day, how much you might have struggled at different times when you're sort of overcome with this quality of restlessness or worry. Have you ever realized at the end of a sitting period that you never once thought of your anchor? I have. I imagine today you may have had some bouts of worry, just sort of that hamster wheel of obsessive thinking. A good friend of mine went on a 3-month retreat in Asia, and he had a fantastic experience and came back to the States, and as soon as he got enough money, he went back for another 3-month retreat, kind of expecting the same thing, which he later acknowledged was a really dumb thing to expect. In his first 6 weeks, he had unending restlessness. He could not sustain focus. His mind was jumpy. He was anxious about everything. He met with his teacher trying to describe his experience, and his teacher responded and said, "I know exactly what you're talking about. I once spent many months struggling with this very thing." He said, "Restlessness can be very challenging." And the teacher suggested a few things. He suggested some self-metta, practicing compassion and kindness as a way of sort of self-calming that anxiety. And he reminded my friend of the importance of concentration, to really give himself fully to the concentration practices, because the byproduct of concentration is calming. So to kind of give a little more to his concentration practice. And so my friend said that what was so interesting about that moment after this intense experience of unrelenting restlessness, that meeting his restlessness with compassion and kindness was very helpful. Remembering the potency of concentration kind of re-inspired him. That was helpful. But he said the most important thing was recognizing that he wasn't alone. That when his teacher said, "I too have struggled with that," something just released inside of him. And that speaks so beautifully to the power of our shared practice. That when any one of these states has you gripped, to remember that we're all experiencing this at different times, that you are not alone in this challenge. So what do we do when we experience these states? They are weather systems, but they feel permanent. When they are present, one of the qualities these have is when they're really there, it's impossible to be present. They occlude the possibility of being awake. So we've talked about this weather system of aversion, when the mind is caught in anger, judgment, blame. We've identified the weather system of craving, planning, fantasy, thinking. We've identified the weather system of sloth and torpor, of worry and restlessness. Before we explore the fifth, there's one thing that I have found so helpful for myself personally, and I shared this in our small group. That when you encounter these challenging states, what I have found helpful is to substitute this phrase, "I want to fix this," with the phrase, "I want to get more familiar with this." There's a world of difference between the two. Back to the acronym of RAIN. Having tea with what arises. The power of recognizing is enormous. As the Buddha said to Mara at the kind of final stages of his enlightenment, he said, "I see you." That is the practice. I see you. As soon as you can see and name what is there, you've begun to sever your identification with it. As they say in the shamanic traditions, if you can name a fear, you take its power away. I'm not sure you fully take its power away, but there is some kind of separation as soon as you recognize it. And sometimes just naming it releases it. As the Tibetans say, some thoughts they're self-liberating. As soon as you see them, they just vanish. the A of this acronym of allowing and accepting, recognizing you've been here before and you'll be here again. What kind of tea would you like? Now, there is a very important element here, because it's important when you ask that question, can I allow this experience? Sometimes you can't. Sometimes it feels like it's too much. Sometimes it may feel overpowering and is tremendously skillful to let it know you see it, to let it know another time when the conditions are different, you want to be with it, but now it's not the time. Shift your attention. Go for a walk, have a cup of tea. It's a very wise and compassionate move. Sometimes when you ask, can I be with this? Does it feel safe to be with this? You will get a felt sense from the body saying, yes, I can make a little more room for it. And when you do, I find it's something like a form of jujitsu. You make more room for it, suddenly there's just more space. It opens up more possibilities. The I of this acronym, to be intimate, to investigate. And this is a softening in, a leaning in. How do we investigate what is here? There are a number of ways, but the primary invitation is to bring the practice back to your body. When you investigate aversion, anger, judgment, blame, where do you feel it? Can you locate it? When you find yourself lost in fantasy and planning, can you draw the attention back and locate how your body holds that experience? With sloth and torpor, with restlessness, there's a quality of a felt sense in the body. When you can recognize it and investigate it there, you are being with it so intimately that can cultivate a very powerful shift. It's not necessarily an intellectual process, but it's something more transcendent. It's direct and experiential. The end, this practice of nourishing, and drawing on compassion and kindness. And Tara will be going into more detail around this tomorrow. But it is really calling on that refuge of love. Let's take just a few minutes to reflect on these qualities, if you wish. You can close your eyes. We can think of this practice of rain as a series of inquiries, a series of questions. In this moment, just opening your attention to the here and now, you might explore this quality of recognizing. What is happening right now? Can you find a word or two that describes this moment? You may notice that there is a happening in the realm of the felt sense of energetically. You may recognize something arising in the realm of thought forms, or the narrative, or commentary. And what is happening in the realm of mood or emotion? You might explore what it means to allow. Can you allow this moment as it is? If you can say yes to this moment, what does that feel like inside? How does your body hold that sense of yes? Exploring what it means to be intimate, to investigate this moment. And you might explore, how much can you feel? How much can you notice? In the realm of the body, the perception of pulse, of tingling, vibration, sensing where energy may feel free-flowing or stagnant or congested. The intimate vibrations of sound. How intimately can you experience the fullness of here and now? You might explore now this quality of nourishing. If you were to invite a quality of loving presence into this moment, what is that like inside? Does anything shift or move or change? You might now deepen your breath. And as you're ready, you can let your eyes open or feel free to remain with them closed. I find there to be a big distinction between thinking that the struggles, that these mind states, these weather systems are in the way of my practice, as opposed to them actually being the practice. When you can substitute trying to fix an experience, simply trying to be more familiar with it, it can open up a deepening sense of intimacy. You can begin to sense the unmet need behind aversion, anger, judgment, blame. The internal discomfort that instigates moving off into fantasy or planning. You might be able to discern the strong emotions inside that might initiate some unconscious desire to numb or push away or spiral down into heaviness or sleepiness. You might be able to sense this relationship between this undigested anxiety and how it might spark off restlessness and worry. It's meeting these challenging states with both interest and compassion that can open the door, if you can say yes, to new possibilities. So one more of these states to speak about. And that is the experience of doubt. I imagine that we've all taken turns hosting doubt through the course of the day. The thoughts of, I can't do this. Everyone is doing this perfectly except for me. Do these teachers really know what they're talking about? Why did I come here? I could be a club med instead of club meditation. How do we work with doubt? Doubt can be crippling, and doubt is intimately tied into the ruthless critic. Just that little voice in the back constantly criticizing. I read of an interview with an Army Ranger who was heading off for advanced training, one of the most difficult trainings. And he was racked with doubt. He was racked with really questioning whether he could survive it. And he tracked down someone who had completed it years earlier. And this is what this fellow said to him. He said, "There's nothing you can't survive in one day if you take it one day at a time." And there's something about that that can be quite helpful. Just today. Just now. So doubt plays through all the time in our experience. And the antidote to doubt is having an understanding, kind of a wisdom and understanding of how things work, but also faith, cultivating faith on some level. There's blind faith, which is just believing something at face value. But there's another important element that's part of our practice here, and it's called verified faith. It's a more mature form of faith. It's you hear something, and then you check it out for yourself and verify if it's true. James Barra said that after a lifetime of meditating and teaching meditation, he said he's never, after sitting for a meditation period, he's never thought, you know, I shouldn't have done that. And the same for retreats. This may be one of the most challenging things you'll ever do. But the fruits of the practice are immeasurable. I remember in one retreat, in a month-long retreat, I was in intense physical pain. And along with that physical pain was a lot of emotional torment. And it really felt like the pain was going to eat me alive. And I remembered that story of the yogini in her cave. And I realized that I was being eaten by demons. It felt like I was being eaten by demons. And so I came back to that practice of just naming what was here, just naming the pain as intimately as I could, asking if I could allow it, opening to it, and leaning into the sensations instead of trying to push them away. Drawing on whatever access I had to compassion, which wasn't much. But something shifted in my relationship to that pain. There, I'll spare you a long story, but there was sort of an insight as to how I was holding that. And I felt something dramatically shift. And what happened for me in that shift, in that kind of opening that followed, when I experienced something similar again, I knew I could be with it. I had verified faith. I once asked Sokni Rinpoche, after a few weeks of intensive practice, had lots of powerful experiences of doing those particular techniques. And I said, what can I expect if I continue, you know, doing these intensive practices? And his response surprised me. He said, confidence. He said, you'll have confidence that you can be with anything. And that's what I have found for myself. And I'm sure to some degree you have found that for yourself. To really trust the practices. One of the most powerful mantras I find, particularly when it comes to working with doubt, is to keep going. Just keep going. Doubt, as crippling as it can be, is a temporary state. It will come, it will grip, it will release, and it will move on. So when you are visited by these states, it's very helpful, I feel, to not try to fix it, to not try to figure out how you're going to get through it as quickly as you can, but to invite it at the door laughing and invite it in, to cultivate an intention to simply be more familiar with what is there. And as the Buddha said, familiarity leads to wisdom. So you have completed one day. You have 6 days remaining. This reminded me of a story we used to tell back in the ashram of this. This one Swami who could look in your eyes and tell you how many lifetimes you had before you'd be liberated. And one of the advanced yogis went to visit with him, and the Swami looked in his eyes and he said, "You have 6 more lifetimes." The guy said, "Are you kidding me? After all I've done, after all these intensive practices and how much I've given, this is ridiculous." And he stormed off. Another person came in. The Swami looked in his eyes. He said, "You have 35 more lifetimes." And he said, "That's all? I'm that close?" And he started dancing ecstatically, and he was liberated. There's an alchemy that helps to transform wherever we are, and that is calling on gratitude. I thought we might close with a short reflection on gratitude. As you close your eyes, you might imagine in these remaining minutes, as you just sense the fullness of this day, a quality of spaciousness. In your own way, sensing this quality of non-judging awareness, who you are in the absence of desire. And acknowledging these weather systems that pass through. Reflecting on this day and the days ahead. The play of aversion. Anger, judgment, blame, ill will. Imagining it like a weather system passing through, gripping, moving on. Acknowledging and sharpening your awareness of the movement of the mind, the weather system that is drawn toward fantasy, planning, lost in desire, and endless craving. The weather system of sloth and torpor, this weather system of heaviness, of density, of sleepiness, this downward spiral. Seeing this as a temporary field that will arise and pass away. This weather system of restlessness, of worry, the play of doubt and the critic. Recognizing perhaps that awareness is none of these. Awareness is that which is aware of these states. And when you can recognize and name what is here, you are in the process of freeing yourself. When you can allow, make room, and rather than push away to explore intimately and investigate this state, to draw on this refuge of kindness and compassion. Reflecting on the gift of this time in your life to step away from the busyness of your life, from your contracts and responsibilities, to take this time . Your food is prepared for you. There are people who are cleaning up for you, people who are concerned for your welfare. This is your time. We'll close with this reading from David White called Sweet Darkness. When your eyes are tired, the world is tired also. When your vision has gone, no part of the world can find you. Time to go into the dark, where the night has eyes to recognize its own. There, you can be sure you are not beyond love. The dark will be your womb tonight. The night will give you a horizon further than you can see. You must learn one thing. The world was made to be free in. Give up all other worlds except the one to which you belong. Sometimes it takes darkness and the sweet confinement of your aloneness to learn anything or anyone that does not bring you alive is too small for you. Namaste. Thank you for being with your sloth and torpor through this talk. It's heartbreaking. I know what a long day it is, the opening night. Thank you for your attention.